I'm at the Puerto with Matthew Slotover, who selected some of the artists. What was the title of your selection? Did it have a title?
Yeah, the selection was 999.
On the theme of emergency.
You got it.
Is there a kind of any sort of particular theme? Did you feel you followed any kind of theme in terms of the way you looked at artists for this section at all?
I think I did follow a theme, yeah. The subtitles of Emergency were emergencies of difference, gender, ecology, things like that. Basically, what they were looking for was, I think, art with some kind of social, political edge. And instead of picking one of those topics that it would have been pretty hard to find eight young artists dealing with in a really intelligent way, I just took it as artists who were involved in those kind of things. That's pretty good, isn't it?
But although you edit a magazine, is this the first time that you've curated or put together a group of artists in this way? I mean,
yes.
Is that right? It is, right, okay. Sure. I mean, is it very different in the sense, did you find it fairly straightforward or was it complicated?
Well, I think a lot of the people who have curated things here are magazine people. Some of them have curated things before, but so I think it's pretty interesting for us to do it, and it's pretty interesting for exhibition curators to look at what we do. I think mine definitely has a kind of editorial flavor to it, where I was thinking more about how the artists link together in my head than how the actual works would look placed to each other, next to each other.
Right in the middle of the space here, there's a quite a lot of activity going on, and there's an aluminium canoe, I think.
Tin
canoe with two large pots of hot water on top. And people are helping themselves to noodles and then standing around eating or sitting at tables and chairs provided. Could you tell me a bit about this artist and this piece? It's somehow a social center in a way that focuses the whole grouping.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you come down through the Aperto and reach this section, which is roughly in the middle, and there's what you usually have in that kind of area, some kind of drinks or food area. I think that's really how people are seeing this piece.
But it's amazing. The whole thing has been devastated. We've been here for maybe an hour and a half into the opening, and already almost all the food is gone. There was a massive stack of cardboard boxes of noodles, and it's been like papers all over the floor. There are empties everywhere. Are these going to stay here? Is that part of the work, or how does it function?
I think these will stay here, yeah. What Rickert usually does over the course of the exhibition is pile up all the waste, not just that people have left, but that he's accumulated in making the piece. And in fact, that's what ends up for sale at the end.
One thing that I find very interesting about your selection is the way you've brought together artists who, in many people's eyes, seem to have quite a kind of definite, formal sense, like, say, Julie Roberts with paintings and Damien Hirst with these very kind of solid, large-scale installations. But then there's also this other side to things. One example of this is the Georgina Starr video. I wonder if you could tell me a bit about that, or maybe I should speak to her.
Well, it's called Mentioning. It's along the bottom there are subtitles, which are actually taken from a conversation she taped off some people on the tube. She's edited it down and put a film over it, which is some little paper models which are being moved about just by static electricity, shaking a board on top of it. They look, in fact, completely drunk. And she's kind of moved them about to correspond to the text that's going underneath. It's pretty funny.
How do you feel that the whole Aperto has worked in terms of the relationship between the curators? Have there been points where the intellectual or the theoretical sides of the Aperto have been discussed amongst groups of you, or has it been reasonably isolated?
We didn't really talk to each other before we got here. Usually, past Aperto, so the curators have got together four or five times and actually discussed who was going to be in it. This time, our decisions were pretty autonomous. So we got here, and it's pretty interesting walking right down it and seeing the different flavors of the different curators' booths. Jeffrey Deitch, American art consultant, has an incredibly open space with a huge 6-foot wall down one side. All the work he's taken is monumentally in scale. And then you get a bit further down, and there's Nicolas Bourriaud's section, which the walls are all at angles. Some people have got huts, some people have got tiny open spaces. It's completely jumbled up. And my section's probably a bit of the British understatement about it.
Is there anything among the work of other artists, apart from ones you selected, that stands out for you so far?
I think Charles Ray's 7.5-ton cube is a really great piece, and it was really funny watching him trying to get it in. And Rudolf Stingel's piece actually works really well here. If you're going for the monumental, then that's the right kind of way to do it, I think.
What's this machine that's running here?
Can I speak in French?
No, because it won't be... I don't think it'll work. Your English is really good, anyway. Can you hear it?
Yeah, but I would like to speak in English with the voice of Ronnie Godard, which would be nice.
I'm here with Philippe Pereno. What's the name of this installation?
This is not not choose a name for this installation. It's just an open space with sometimes snow, and there's some pictures and emotion pictures, like, say, Samuel Fuller. And people can use this image and make some...
What are these things? There seem to be some sort of puppets in the background here.
It's a
Matisse.
Yeah, it's very famous painting.
Yves Klein.
Yeah, Kurt.
Renoir.
Renoir and Picasso. And
right.
There is sometimes snow and sometimes not snow.
There's
and
a snow-making machine here.
Snow-making machine. And people, it's a sort, you know, of a sort of proposal for a humanitarian festival, something like that, like Bob Geldof used to make band head or something like that. It is always people very nice, non-critiquable, and nobody can critique a singer because he just sing but I just can say not sing so well, but that's it. And I want to make this sort of humanitarian festival and invite dead artists, you know, to celebrate or to fight against death today. So it's sort of how can we see reality, or how can we see pictures we don't really want to see, maybe, I don't know, something like that. And so if you want, you can use and participate to this sort of very stupid festival. That's it.
There aren't the images that make up these kind of banners and puppets are all French, like kind of very famous French artists. It's not an international thing.
No,
it's very specific.
Yeah, I don't really trust in communication. So, you know, I'm French, and why do I have to make a sort of optically correct thing? You know, like you say, politically correct. No, so I just choose what I found near my home. So just posters come from Beaubourg, because I just live near Beaubourg, for instance. So it was very easy for me, you know. I'm not a hard worker. I just find things and buy it, and then that's it.
I'm with Philippe Pereno in the Aperto section of the 1993 Venice Biennale, his installation, not yet titled, from the series No More Reality. The piece comprises, along the back wall, four images taken from famous artworks of the 20th century, significant artworks, a Matisse, an Yves Klein, a Renoir, and a Picasso. And in the foreground, a snow machine pumps foamy snow into a heap. Carsten Holler, what's the title of this piece?
The title is Pest Control.
Could you tell me a bit about it, possibly?
Well, pest control has kind of a double significance. First, you have this pest, this disease and, from the Middle Ages. On the other hand, pest control in English just means control of something that is noxious. That is, for instance, some noxious animal that is too common, you know, that is, you have to do something against, something in this sense. So it's just you have something to fight against.
What we have here is a Land Rover that's had a few adaptations. It's got a couple of nets on the back, large nets. Are they normally for catching animals? What are they for in this instance, these kind of netting things?
What you first see is just that the car is produced to catch something, but you don't really know what it is. You see the nets on the back. You see these kind of wooden sticks with kind of lasso on it. You see that people can sit on the roof in order to use these sticks. You can see that they can sit on the front of the car. And then you see a big cage in the back of it. So apparently they're going to catch something. And if you want to find out what they're going to catch, you have to look more closely inside. And then there are a few things to see. First you can see some candy, which may be used as bait. Huh? Then there's a strange head with something on it. And then you see here, I don't know how this is called in English, the things you have there that children have in their mouth to correct the teeth.
There are two or three braces on the dashboard,
yeah,
which are used to straighten your teeth.
And then when you go on the back, it becomes even more obvious because you see these glasses, children glasses broken.
Yeah.
And they're, you know, they're very strong glasses, like for a child is really not able to see very well. And some gloves and also some footprints on the this polyester stuff, or how do you call this?
I mean, it could be said in a way that some of the territory that you're dealing with in your work is somehow quite difficult. It's something that people never really like to discuss. It's like there's an element of humor in it, but maybe for some people there might be some moral discussion going on as well about things.
But it never happened to me that people were really upset by all this children molesting and killing stuff. It never happened. Even parents who have, I don't know how many children are quite happy when they see this, because somehow everybody hates children. Even if you have children, you hate them because they, you know, they make a lot of noise and they cry all the time and they take all your time. They cost a lot of money and everything. So somehow you hate them. But on the other hand, you're still happy to produce them. And this is the question I really want to ask. Why do you do this? Mm. What is the reason after this? What is the mechanism? How does it work? Why do we love them? Is there also another way of looking at them? Is it necessary to be really friendly to them when we see them? Are they not kind of a pest that it would be much better to control? Because, in fact, of course, there are also much too many on this world. And why is this that we love them? And, you know, just looking at it from a different angle.
There's a sense in which some of your work has a kind of formal, you can make a comparison between it and certain things that have happened before. When some people I know saw some of the videos, and when they weren't really thinking about it too hard, they only saw this kind of procedure, like injecting things or digging a hole on the beach. There are videos from say 20 years ago, of a piece of work which might only involve digging a hole on the beach, or might only involve injecting a sweet with no
video. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This seems quite strong to me in the work. Is that coming from anything specific? Is it coming from college or influence, do you think, or is it just accident?
Well, this is very difficult to answer, but I think it's more accident, because I never went to an art academy.
Right.
I have a training as a scientist. I worked as a scientist for 5 years, and before I did all this education to become a scientist. So I think it was just like I had this idea with the trap, with the jellyfish, what you said before, that I dig a hole, I fill it up with jellyfish, and I put a very little bit of sand over it and kind of a toy as a bait. I had this idea already in 86, because I found a little paper where I wrote this down. And this, for the video, I just put together all these old ideas that accumulate over time and then put it all together and make sense. But I'm not really thinking of this land art thing, or how do you see this in historic artistic tradition and this kind of relationship. It doesn't really interest me so much, because I don't know too much about it, I'm afraid to say.
I'm with Simon Patterson in the Aperto section of the Biennale, and the works here, is this two works or one work?
they're two works, but they're operating away. I suppose you could say they're operating as one work in this case.
What we have is on two side walls facing each other. We have the list of people who attended the Last Supper. Is that right?
That's correct.
And the names are arranged in a very specific way on the wall and painted in. Are they painted on the wall?
They're painted on the wall. That's very important rather than anything. They're painted in a typewriter typeface. And they're arranged according to soccer schematic way, which soccer formations are arranged as you see them in newspapers or on television. On one wall we've got the Last Supper arranged according to the flat back four formation, Jesus Christ in goal. And on the other we have the Last Supper arranged according to the sweeper formation, which is the continental style of play, or it's usually continental style of play.
Showing this work in Italy maybe gives it a slightly different, or gives it an edge that maybe it wouldn't have somewhere else. Have you had much reaction to it so far?
Well, I was talking to an Italian gallery owner who seemed to find it entertaining, and he seemed to get the difference between the piece. He originally thought that he asked me whether or not I was a religious artist or not, which made me think that maybe it does give it put it in a different context.
But in a straightforward sense, it does definitely combine two interests, Italian interests in football and religion. Is there a sense in which this is maybe the ultimate list for you, or is this just another list, like in the past where you've taken groups of names, and specifically with the Republicans book?
No, I would say that it's a different piece. This one is quite an early piece where I went from paintings with individual names on canvases, and it's very much a play about painting. In this case, I think the piece is very much about dogma. You know, the dogma, it's not just that there's the coincidence of 13 people at the Last Supper and that potentially 13 players on a football field on any side. It's also the partly the rigidity of the scheme, considering this is how it's represented, but football is very fluid. And also the idea of it's also marrying that with the idea of dogma, and the two dogmas here are almost like the, you could almost say having the two together, which I've never shown them both together in this way before. It's almost like the dogma between Catholicism and Protestantism or whatever. I mean, that isn't necessarily how people need to take it, but that was how I conceived it, putting the two together. And of course, having the two teams here makes up a full game.
Your decision to show a relatively early piece of work is quite interesting to me, in the sense that particularly this Aperto is very fractured. There's a lot of work all over the place. There are things on the floor. There's a lot of debris. When you walk into this space, it's extremely clean. It's very straightforward. It's not fussy, but it's very direct. Was that a premeditated decision to approach the Aperto in that way?
Yes. I mean, partly it was because logistically I thought that it would be the most straightforward piece to make. I mean, it's time-consuming, but it's not very technically difficult to make the work. And that's important with this, with a lot of things to do anyway, that anybody could make one. But also that I didn't want to make... I didn't feel I wanted to make a sort of grand gesture or something that necessarily shouted, and if people miss it, they miss it. I don't mind that. I mean, you take it or leave it with work anyway. So if people, I didn't want to treat the Aperto as a competition.
I'm here with Carter Costera, and the installation comprises a large wall drawing on one side, and a tower, what could best be described as a kind of tower in the middle, with these large perspex spheres rolling around a kind of tracking system, a bed.
and a luggage cart with another, I call them bowling balls. Since I live in America, you know, it's...
Okay. Tell me about the tower piece.
Yeah, it's called Body Tower. The whole installation is called Reality Check. Each piece has its own title. The tower is called Body Tower. What it is, it's four balls that are basically bowling balls, 12-inch diameter, male and female heads, and male and female genitals. And it's basically the idea of how, you know, a man and woman, they're supposed to have this connection together. They're not even a whole person. They're a separate person, separate body, and separate. There's no communication between the two. And it's very much the same thing with the head on the luggage cart, is that it's this head that's just traveling aimlessly anywhere it's going. It's being carted around. Personally, what I've done with it is kicked it around the world and shot videotape of myself kicking my head around the world. That's the same.
So one of these is you?
Yeah, this one here. This one's right. Actually me. You can see it. The other balls are actually generic heads and generic body parts, like sex toy vaginas and penises and fabricated heads.
Right. So what you're really looking at is a kind of perspex sphere. And inside that, set within the resin, is a fabricated head made of what?
Made out of the same material as the ball. It's actually not perspex. It's actually polyester resin. And the actual objects inside are polyester resin as well. Then we have this bed piece where there's male and female heads that act as the footing of the bed. And the bed is then suspended on the heads. And there's a sort of a... I guess we're a non-gender figure that has the appearance of being melted through a perspex mattress. And it's sort of like being at a state of sort of it's like a hyper state where it's neither, it hasn't arrived at its state yet. It appears as if it's melting and going to change form, but it's sort of suspended in its state. And that's, you know, at the base of the text where I have this sort of generalizations or insults, however you want to take it, where I'm saying all British are snobs, all Americans are obnoxious, all Canadians are nice, all Germans are Nazis, which is true, all Italians are horny, which is true, all French are rude. And it's basically the whole idea that, you know, society today is that we have things with the ECC bringing Europe together. Then we have places like Yugoslavia breaking up. We have places like the Soviet Union breaking up. We have problems in Canada with Quebec always wanting to separate. So it's the idea of that is migration. And these are all sort of migratory sculptures in a way because they're going from transition. They're not really connected to anything. They're all sort of following a track, whether they're rolling on a track or in a suspended space, or actually being physically me carrying them on this luggage cart and carrying it around.
People are free to roll these bowling ball spheres around this track.
Yes. And at certain points, too, I have an assistant who's dressed as sort of a futuristic warrior who's playing classical violin, and he stands in the middle of this track. And it's just sort of the idea of man and warrior attitude, and then the sensitivity, you know. So almost playing like a battle song in a way, a ridiculous one.
It's notable on this large wall drawing thing that it does say all Canadians are nice about halfway down, which is actually something that people do say, along with eating donuts and drinking beer.
Yeah, that's right, and you know, playing hockey and chasing beavers and moose, but. Actually, all these texts, they all came from actual people saying them to me. I hadn't made up any of these texts. All these things people actually say. I was actually arrested in Virginia Beach a few years back and had to produce a driver's license, and the cop said, "Oh, you're from Canada. I thought all Canadians were nice." So that's where that one came from.
Is this section of the show that you've put together, is this fairly... representative of the kind of projects you've been doing in the last few years, or is this something quite new?
Well, the text actually comes from earlier work, and this body, yes, it is. The balls are the latest things I've been working on, and I have worked in this idea of transitoriness with the melting wax. I created a piece called The Disappearing Family 2 years ago, where I cast an entire family in wax, and I had heat lamps above the heads of them, and over a course of 5 weeks, the entire family was melted away to nothing. And then the wax was then collected and placed into urns, so that urn then took the place of the actual physical family. So it was just now ashes, you know, or wax.
I'm in the space of Kirsten Oppenheim, and there's a sound piece running in here. I'm with Meg Cranston in the Aperto, and around me there are a number of what I can best describe as columns covered in various fabrics, plastics. Each one has a name and a number on it. Could you tell me a little bit about this work?
Well, each of the columns, as you say, represent a different historical figure. So Pavlova, the ballet dancer Pavlova, Thomas Edison, the poet Emily Dickinson, Che Guevara, so various historical figures. And the height of each column was determined by the number of books on that person in the University of California library system, which is the largest university system in North America. So there's a Nureyev, which is only, you know, not even 2 feet high. He has 18 books. Emily Dickinson is actually two columns over more than 10 feet high because she has 348 books. So the little tags on each column, they say their name and the number of books, which correspond to that person. And then there's no actual books, so they're just are the amount of space that those books would occupy, and that's conveyed by this understructure. And then the cover, which is like a book cover, and I chose these different fabrics to make a kind of poetic choices, really whimsical choices, but somewhat related to the people. So Nijinsky's pink because he's a ballet dancer, and Emily Dickinson because a lot of her poetry deals with nature, has a floral pattern. Che Guevara is red because he's communist, you know, these sort of stupid relationships. And wool because of, I associate that with like his life as a guerrilla, you know, warfare. But then it has a silly like black fringe on it. So it's not, it's related to, or I guess I suppose it's a poetic use of statistics in a sense that in my, I'm presenting it and saying, well, in my survey, Thomas Edison is bigger than, say, Marconi. So in this survey, he seems more important. Or Parnell is gigantic. So I've kind of manipulated the data of history to make it seem like this one's more important than that one. Of course, I could have chosen a different set of characters and come up with another solution. So the covers are kind of fanciful in that they mean to convey that kind of silliness of statistics and deflect that serious conceptual art kind of feeling.
Which came first, the desire to create some object, or the interest in this research or cataloging, maybe you could call it?
Well, I've always been interested in how you translate one kind of information into another kind of information. So how can I make it the Edison's importance compared to Marconi physical? So you can stand next to Edison and sort of measure his importance next to your own even. You know, how do I measure up? And it's a little bit of spoofing on the whole Aperto or the whole Biennale idea that there's a competition going on, like who's the biggest... who's the biggest figure, who's most important.
How does this work as a whole relate to other things that you've done in the past? Maybe there's a specific work that you'd like to mention that somehow precedes this or informs this project.
Well, I've done a lot of work which tends to be about counting or listing, but the one I think that's most like it, I did a piece where I made a giant balloon which contained the amount of air that it would take to read the complete works of Jane Austen. So it was a way, again, of trying to show something which is invisible, the experience of reading those books, something which is invisible and making it visible. So you could stand next to Jane Austen's work and I feel dwarfed by it. You know, it's this enormously huge balloon. And you imagine, well, how big would, you know, Tolstoy be next to Jane Austen? So it's, again, about sizing people up. One thing I realized from it is that even people you think would have a lot of books on, say, or people who are huge figures like, I don't know, Madonna, there's no books on her. So unless she gets some books, she's probably in 50 years forgotten. So if you want a place in history, have someone write a book on you.
I'm with Hirsch Perlman, who's made a piece for the Aperto section of the Biennale. Could you tell me a little bit about the piece, the name of the piece?
The name of the piece is called The Layman's Practical Guide to Interrogation, First Draft. And it is just what its title describes it as. It's a manual on how to conduct interrogations. I've been working on it almost for a year. There was a rough draft before this, and then this is the first draft, and it's written with the attitude that anybody at all might want to or have a need to conduct an interrogation, and that anybody at all may be a potential source of information. The content of information is not discussed at all. The manual is really only about techniques, question types, and various other concerns that one might have if they were going about.
So is the basically the format of the piece is a table with a number of large sheets of paper enclosed in plastic folders that you can, I presume you can shuffle through them and pick things out and read them. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's quite an accessible work in that way. I mean, it's something to be used. Yeah, in a sense.
I'm glad to hear you say so. Sometimes I have the feeling that it's, although maybe it's not what you mean by accessible, but it's usable, but it's very usable, but it is a work that I think for some people has a problem of, you know, if they're going to use it. I mean, whether not use it in the sense of worrying about the interrogation, but that's even a lot to get some people to do, is to walk up to a table and start rifling through this pile of drawings. Which is perfectly all right with me, what I'd like them to do, but there's 40-some drawings there, and even if people are interested, I think sometimes they're a bit inhibited to actually rifle through the pile. My work's always, it's actually always been around rhetoric or various kinds of vocabularies that set up systems of rhetoric that, in the long run, are about ways at arriving at or assuming certain kind of truths for various purposes, different truths for different purposes. The work has never implied I think it's never implied any kind of particular morality or particular ethics, but is around it. But it circumscribes or outlines rhetoric. But for me, what's interesting about that is that you can't discuss rhetoric without developing a rhetoric and doing it. And I think that's if you're trying to relate it back to art, I mean, I think that's where the hinge is, that you're implicated in the work immediately, you know, and at some point perhaps made self-conscious about what constructs you use when you make meaning. You know, this thing about truth is that, you know, of course there isn't one. I mean, pretty naive to be thinking that these days. But that the issue comes down to, like, at what point do you decide on a meaning for something? You know, I mean, and what gets you there? I mean, that's what I'm interested in making people aware of, if that can happen at all. It's a work that's trying to communicate the impossibility of communicating. I mean, and that's maybe kind of a dumb cliche way to end up describing it. But I actually am really interested in things that can kind of be really dumb in a certain way and still have resonance.
I'm talking to Giorgio Vizzotti about the exhibition, and I wondered, critic, curator,
and so.
What do you feel about the aperte?
Oh, I think aperte is very nice and an addition this year. And I've seen a lot of very interesting works in the style do the right thing. So most of the artists are doing the right thing right now. And then I think it's the most interesting show to see, exhibition to see here.
As an Italian, how important is the aperto and in fact the whole Biennale for the discourse that goes on in Italy between artists and critics? Is it an important event for you?
I couldn't answer. You mean for Italian artists,
yeah, really,
in Italy?
Yeah, more the Italian artists.
I think that for them being or not being at the aperto doesn't make really sense. I mean, not for their success in Italy. Maybe it's a very good opportunity for them to be shown in for an international audience. That's very nice.
Is it a pressure for them, do you think? Is it quite tough?
Yes, I think it's for them it's worse than for the others, for American or German or English, as usual, anyway. I think that the Biennale doesn't change things for them, so it's just an opportunity.
And begin the last 2 minutes, David.
2 minutes. That's the last minute of the aerobics.
Sylvie Fleury's piece, Legs, Body and Mind, it's a number of video recorders and monitors scattered around on the floor with a large black wall painting to one side with the word Egoist written on it, taken from the magazine advertisement. And here's some of the noise that's coming from these videos, which they're all showing various workout tapes, like Jane Fonda workout and that kind of thing.
For jumping rope, for doing your stairway exercise. And begin the last 2 minutes, David.
2 minutes. That's the last minute of the aerobics. It's our last big sweat. Come on, get your knees up, get your knees up.
For jumping rope, for doing your stairway exercise.
With Christine Borland, whose piece in the show is called
A Lifetime of Love.
And I wondered if you could describe the piece. It's layers of blankets, is that right?
Yes, it's probably about 150 odd blankets. I didn't count them all, but they're piled on top of each other to form almost a bed height, size. They're all folded very neatly so that the top cover is the one which dictates the size of the whole piece. The top cover is kind of the key to the work in that it's a really well-loved, well-patched, well-worn top cover, a patchwork quilt which has been in my possession since I was in Belfast about 5 years ago. And used to hunt things like that down in all the second-hand markets and stuff, so it is genuinely well-loved by me.
What, hunted down as something to use for a possible piece of work, do you mean?
Yes, but it was also part of the kind of therapy of coping with being in that kind of context as well. It was lots and lots of shopping and gathering objects that had already had a previous life around you when you were in a new place, which in itself was quite a frightening and kind of volatile place to be in. So the work that I've been making in the past few years does still pick up on threads that were started during that time, and this piece certainly does, although I haven't given it a title which relates to that context, and normally I wouldn't really talk about it as being, you know, as relating to that sort of, I mean, it is for me, but it doesn't have to be overt in the work at all.
But when you see the piece in the gallery, it's sort of squared off. It's the stacking of the blankets is quite precise and definite. Could you tell me about the other work in the show? And also, is this a new piece that you've done for the exhibition? Or
A Lifetime of Love is brand new. In fact, I wasn't 100% sure of the presentation because I've never tried it out with so many blankets before. So there was a lot of trying different ways of presentation out when I came here, a few days of kind of just settling into the space and just finding the right position and the right way to present the work, which is part of what I usually do anyway, so that isn't unusual. Although it was a lot more stressful in this context because it's so public. So it's a brand new piece, and the shoes with the 9mm holes, which is 9mm hole rather, it's a piece that I made last year for a group show. But I've been making a kind of series of these works with different size holes, which relate to different size bullet holes. So in a way, this the work that I've done here, it's kind of coming to the end, I think, of the work that I've been doing with shooting and working with the police and the army and various people to get these things done. It's kind of coming to the end of that. So I ended up not wanting to use any work which was actually shot in this show, because I kind of feel that I'm starting on to something new now. So the blanket piece especially, but this, the shoes is kind of, it's still making a reference to that, although it's not actually shot, it's just the size of the bullet hole.
What do you think about the context of the whole show in terms of your work? Do you feel that there are people in the show that you're interested in? Is the placement, especially for Matthew Slotova's selection, is very open, it's relatively open.
Yeah, I mean, it's, in that sense, it's a bit like any group show that's been curated. There are people in the show that you wouldn't necessarily choose to show with in an ideal world, but in a group show, it just has to... It should, the curator is the one who's the director, and they should be arranging things because it's their choice, and the artists have to just make adjustments and try and get the best that they can for their work and the best that they can in general out of the thing. It's almost, you know, it's like almost going back to your degree show at college. You have a big space which everyone has to fit into, but there's no you don't feel any particular strong reason about why you're there with Damien as opposed to anyone else that you know.
I'm sitting with Nicolas Bourriaud in the Giardini, and he's the curator of part of the Aperto this year with the title Standards. Could you tell me what artists you selected for this part of the Aperto?
I selected a Belgian artist called Patrick van Kekenberg, a Dutch artist Nick van der Steeg, and three French artists also, Philippe Pareno, Collection de Vautour, and Fabrice Hibert, and also Sean Landers from New York. There's always one missing, you know. Nicolas Schaffhausen and Angela Bullock.
There's quite a diversity in the work that you've chosen, and in many ways also your position as a both a critic and a curator changes everything a little, because there are critics who have selected parts of the Aperto, and there are also curators who have selected parts of the Aperto, but not so many people who've had such experience across a larger field. How does this Aperto compare with your whole project, your other things, your other shows?
First, you know, I work mainly about theory, you know, and trying to explore new ways of thinking art. You know, it's the most interesting thing for me. And also showing, you know, curating a show is something that is quite exceptional for me. I like to do it every year or every 2 years, but not more, because I think we don't have things to say every year actually. You know, then it really depends on the new issues you found and etc. You said that the artists I show are really diverse, but also they all share something which is quite important. I think they all try to explore other domains, other fields than the artistic one, you know. For example, Nick van der Steeg works exactly like an architect. Patrick van Kekenberg is kind of entomologist, you know, working about insects and etc. Philippe Pareno works as a kind of director, you know. There are a lot of different methods that are used, which, according to me, are the most important trying to find new ways of working, you know, is the most interesting issue of actual art.
Is there any particular work that stands out from the whole exhibition, or is it not possible really to look at it in that way? I mean, you've got a... What I find interesting always is this idea of spectacle and creating such a large exhibition. Inevitably, someone tries to make a big statement or some kind of special thing. This year, it seems more confused. Even someone like Damien Hirst hasn't quite... There's no sense of spectacle. No one's so interested. In this way, your selection seems very successful somehow, because the question of spectacle or sensation is somehow it's not the central issue. You don't go away feeling one thing is really leading everything else. It's much more complex.
Actually, let's say that currently there are some group shows artists, you know, artists that really work well in group shows only, you know, that are not able to exist by themselves, you know. And I think the Aperto is full of artists like that, because it's an actuality show. It's not nothing more. As a critic, you know, I think there are two different directions we can explore, you know. The first is the monographic classical way of talking about artists, which is trying to explore one person's universe. The other way is to take artworks as elements of a kind of kaleidoscopic actuality, and the Aperto is more like that, I think. But I tried to combine both, showing people that I like, then which they don't have no particular relations between each other, actually. You know, there's nothing nothing in common between Nick van der Steeg and Angela Bullock, you know. Absolutely don't care, because I tried to show individuals, you know, more than group shows artists.
How much control do you take over the work people actually exhibit in the end? Are you making suggestions to the artists about work they've made in the past, or are you waiting for them to just say, this is my work, and do it that way?
Then again, there are two different solutions, you know. The first one is to create a show with artworks. That's what Jeffrey Deitch did, for example, showing works that have already been shown before, for example. And I didn't want to know for this show what the artist would propose, you know. I'd prefer it to be a kind of surprise for me. And I didn't know, for example, what Angela Bullock did would have proposed. I didn't know what Philippe Parreno wanted to show only 15 days before the Biennale. And I just curated a show of artists, not of artworks. I think it's really important to separate the two.